Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello everybody and welcome to Black Hole Cinema. We are back with a vengeance, or maybe not with a vengeance. That suggests we've been, you know, angry and on a crusade to kill people, which we haven't. That's not what we've been doing. We've just had a break over the summer to recharge our batteries, do other things. We, as in me, Tony Black, curator and host this week of Black Hole Cinema, and with me, the two co-hosts of the show, Mr. Dan Taylor.
Hello, it's good to be back.
And Lady Judy Hench, a.k.a. Emma
Platt. Dame Judy Hench.
And this is why, like, we have to call her these things, because she gets angry very quickly at things. She does. Have we had a nice summer?
It's all right. Didn't do much.
I've spent the whole thing working. We bought a new cinema on the 26th of June, so I was... Well, we've been working very hard this summer to get that up and running, and running the way we want it to. I finished there in the end of September, so it's been a long old slog. And then potentially, I'm off to Thurso, which is just north of Inverness. Hey!
No way, really?
Yeah. Well, basically, my job now is to go and like open these new cinemas that we take on, so wherever they are in the world. I'd really like one in Madrid or Barcelona or something, you know, exotic.
I was going to say, you know, no, of all the places.
It's one of the coldest places in the country, and it's never been warmer than 24 degrees, which is, what, room temperature, isn't it?
Brilliant. Next stop, Reykjavik, and yeah. Onwards north. Yeah, you'll be at the wall before you know it, but that's good. And Emma, you had a chilled summer?
I had surgery, didn't I? So I've literally spent all summer in bed.
Ah.
So that wasn't fun. You told me I'd be back on my feet in 4 days, and it's been 4 weeks, and I'm still just like, no! So that's fun. That's fun. And I've got more surgery to have, so super fun.
Are you sure you're super not just milking fun. This so you can watch a lot of Netflix?
Do you know what? I haven't even watched any Netflix. I literally just slept and bitched most of the time, which is really no different than usual. And I had to sort of go back to uni, and...
We've had a busy time. I've been moving
Sorting
house.
Out life.
Yes, life stuff. I've been moving house and going on to weddings and nice stuff. All good, all nice stuff, don't get me wrong, but just busy. Just very, very busy. So,
makes you feel old, doesn't it? Weddings and stuff like that. You suddenly realise you're an adult.
Yeah, it's difficult. I had three on the bounce. Three weddings in 3 weeks. It was like an endurance test. And they were all in different parts of the country. There was one Lincolnshire, then one in Kent, and then one in Wiltshire. So it was crazy times. But
I've only ever been to three weddings. One was my own, so...
That doesn't count, surely, as in terms of guests.
Going to a wedding.
I did go to one wedding this summer, and I was kind of like, why would someone assume I've got something to wear for a wedding? And then I was like, oh, because I'm nearly 30, and people start to get married now. Like, I was really, like, quite annoyed that I had to buy something new to go to a wedding.
I was going to say, you didn't just go in your hospital gown or anything.
No, but I was going to go in my old wedding dress.
That would have been wonderfully ironic.
just being like, well, you know, if you're wearing one, I'm going to wear one.
So yeah, we've been busy, but we're back, and this is our summer special, just to hack into quite a busy summer, really, of all the blockbuster season movies that have been out. Although I don't really know whether it can be really labelled as blockbuster season anymore, because it doesn't really work that way anymore, does it? You get tentpole massive releases all over the year now, so it's not like the summers of old where it would be all the big blockbuster massive movies, and then the rest of the year is all these little pottering indies. It's all changed.
I actually think the money's actually so far been taken before the summer, pretty much. Mm. You know, the biggest releases of the year kind of came around like February, March, April time, which is very unusual. Obviously, your 50 Shades of Grey, Fast Furious 7, Avengers, obviously. So yeah, it was actually the earlier months, really, this year. I've not actually looked at the overall figures for the year. I don't know where we are at the moment in terms of.
I'm looking at them now, just for what we've got so far. Mm-hmm. Like, there's Jurassic World number one. You've got Avengers: Age of Ultron, Furious 7, Inside Out, Minions, then Cinderella, which was like, that was February, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, February, very early.
Pitch Perfect 2, Mission Impossible, Home. Is that the little cartoon?
That was March. Yeah.
That's number 9 so far. I'm on Box Office Mojo. 50 Shades of Grey, yep. SpongeBob the Movie, San Andreas, Fury Road, Straight Outta Compton, The Divergent Series, Insurgent, Kingsman, Spy, Trainwreck, and Tomorrowland.
Are these America? Yeah. Are these American ones?
I think worldwide.
Worldwide, yeah.
So really, the only massive one this summer really has been Jurassic World.
Again, that's before the summer, really. It's before the kids broke up. It was June.
Yeah,
it falls before what was considered blockbuster season, I guess, wasn't it, really? It doesn't work the same way anymore. Yeah. But
in the UK, it's Jurassic World, Avengers, Minions, Furious 7, Inside Out, 50 Shades of Grey, Home, Cinderella, The Theory of Everything, and Big Hero 6, which make up the top 10, Mission Impossible just missing out. So actually, it's really only Mission Impossible, which misses out on the UK box office, and obviously on the American side, it just makes it in. So otherwise, it's just Inside Out. It's just the kids' film, really, that both sides of the pond, you know, breaks quite dramatically into that top 10. Everything else so far, unusually, is earlier on.
Well, that's a good place to start then, really, because we're going to go by order of date. So we last recorded our podcast and released it on July the 23rd, and we covered Ant-Man primarily, which was just before the cut-off when we went off on holiday. On July 24th, the weekend of, first big release was Pixar's Inside Out.
I'm joy. This is sadness. That's anger.
What?
This is disgust. And that's fear. We're Riley's emotions. Riley's memories. They're mostly happy, you'll notice, not to brag.
I wanted to maybe hold one.
What happened? Sadness?
She did something to the memory.
Is everything okay?
I don't know.
Take it back, Joy!
I'm trying. Joy, no,
let's
wait.
Go!
The core memories!
No!
Now, I'm not sure. Emma, you've definitely seen this, haven't you?
Yeah. Me and Freddie went to see it, and I know everyone's probably seen the trailers, and it's about this little girl called Riley and her emotions, and I really enjoyed Inside Out. I think Pixar films have got a depth to them that DreamWorks lacks. There's just like little things all the way through the film that I was like, oh, I want to see more of that. There was a bit when Joy, who was voiced by Amy Poehler? Her and Sadness are like stuck somewhere else in Riley's mind, and they see these mind workers taking a memory of a jingle from a commercial and sending it up to like head office basically, and like Anger's like, no, not this again, and it was little things like that kind of fleshed the movie out a lot. And compared to like the Minions movie, there was a lot in it for like, the story was enough to hold my attention, but it was bright and colourful enough that Freddie was really fascinated with it. And the show beforehand, Lava, I've been singing that song all summer.
I think that's
one of the best shorts I've seen.
Yeah,
I really, sweet. Really enjoyed this. I think it's one of those I could watch it a few times and still find something different in it. There was just quite a lot to it. I really enjoyed it. It was kind of sweet, and it was kind of funny, and it was kind of sad, and it's everything you expect of a Pixar film. And I think the last couple of films they've made haven't really been up to what I expect of them. Like,
no.
Monsters University was okay. Cars 2, Brave was all right. But I haven't really enjoyed a Pixar film since, like, probably Up.
I really
enjoyed this.
I wouldn't say it's as good as Up. I think Up for me was quite a special film. However, I will admit that in the closing parts of the film, I was choking up a little bit. It was good, Up had, you know, Up practically had me crying within the first 10 minutes. That opening 10 minutes of Up is incredible, and this one, but it's great. Pixar are brilliant in the way they're able to kind of, you know, as Emma said, hold the attention of the adults. Actually, adults actually enjoying the film probably just as much, if not more, than the kids that are accompanying. And it's also what it says about society, and because there's little kind of pokes at kind of San Francisco, and about, you know, there's jokes about kind of how preppy it is, and you've got the broccoli on pizza and stuff like that, and how they're kind of talking about how it's kind of trying to become more trendy and cool and trying to do things a bit like kind of quirky, and, you know, stuff like that, which kids wouldn't necessarily pick up on and think anything of, but obviously as adults we go, oh yeah, that's funny. And obviously what it says about kind of relationships as well, the kind of the relationship between the mum and the dad, and obviously we get a little brief look inside their heads as well, and kind of what their kind of emotions are saying about one another, about, you know, oh, he's not paying attention again, and kind of him going, the dad kind of realising, oh shit, I'm supposed to, you know, kind of chime in here. It's very funny how they are able to actually get quite deep. But, no, but yeah, it was a good film. It was solid. Certainly the strongest kids' film of the year. And it's exactly what you would expect from Pixar.
I don't think it quite hit the same emotional chord as the Toy Stories or Up, for me. I think there were moments like with the invisible friend. What was his name?
Bing Bong.
Bing Bong, that's it. That was very sad and quite sweet when she had to leave him behind and everything like that. But I think it didn't quite connect with me in that way, but I think what really impressed me more than anything else was the and you've touched on this a little bit already, the depth of creativity involved, and the not just like in terms of the kind of things it's talking about and the kind of, you know, ideas that it's putting across about growing up and growing old and, you know, going from being a child to a teenager and all this, but the depth of thought in the how they presented that, you know, with all the worlds within her mind.
Mm.
And, you know, all the constructs that make up, like, the island of personality.
That's personality, yeah.
Mm. It's amazing. I mean, that to create that level of world building was phenomenal. And so I think in terms of that, I think it's the most, I think it's the cleverest Pixar film without a shadow of a doubt they've ever done. I don't think it's quite the most emotional, but I think it's the cleverest.
But do you not think that when you talk about it, you know, it's not the same as, like, Toy... Do you not think that you've got a different, like, kind of connection to Toy Story? Because, obviously, the first one came out so long ago when we were all a lot younger. So it's got, like, a kind of a different meaning, I think. I mean, when I watched Toy Story 3, I remember everyone going on about how sad it was. I just kind of didn't feel that emotional connection to it anymore. But when I saw Up, especially, like, and I went for the first 10 minutes, which is, like, the worst 10 minutes ever. But that hit me in a different way because, you know, being like a growing up, and like when I watched Up, I was going through a lot of stuff with trying to have a baby, and that what they showed on screen in those few seconds really hit me quite hard. So that affected me on a different level than like Toy Story and, you know, like losing your childhood and things like that. But I kind of think, and I think that's something Pixar does really well, because me being back then, you know, I was like 23 years old. And a cartoon film being able to make me sob my eyes out, it was something that was so grown up and so personal, that when you think about how they can get you like that. But I think Inside Out, it was kind of like, especially when she left Bing Bong, it reminded me a little bit of, well, my childhood's kind of gone, you know, and I've left all these Toy Story because it came out like 1985. So we're all a lot, we kind of like, I think it's nostalgia sometimes for things like that.
Yeah, I think so. I think, for me, though, I mean, I didn't watch the Toy Stories until I was an adult. so I never saw them at the cinema, weirdly enough. But I didn't quite have that same feeling with it. But I think you're right. I think it will depend on your age, definitely. There'll be a lot of young kids who think that Inside Out is their favourite Pixar and is the Pixar that means the most to them. And I think the fact that it can do that at different ages is really important. And it just does more and says more than almost all other live action films, really. Every Pixar film can do more, manages to do more and say more about the human condition and about childhood and all these things than most other real life films can, live action films can. So no, it was extremely good.
I think it's in like my top three Pixar films, definitely. Like I really enjoyed it, and it was one of those films that came out, and I spoke to like my boyfriend about it. Like it was like when I went to Minions, I was like, "Oh shit," and that was it. But I was like, "Oh, this happens and then oh, and there's this little bit here." Like it was one of those. It was like it's just like the way the characters were designed. Like they were a bit like fuzzy around the edges and stuff. It's the little things like that really set Pixar apart from all the other crap that we see churned out all the time. And obviously I notice it because Freddy watches any animated shit that they shove in Sky, like, and he'll watch it over and over and over again, and you can really tell the difference in what Pixar put out and what someone else puts out. And I think other studios really need to up their game if they want to keep up with Pixar, especially now it's Pixar Disney, you know, and they've got Disney behind them. Because I think the only thing from DreamWorks I've really enjoyed is being How to Train Your Dragon. Like, nothing else touches Pixar, and I kind of think, what are other studios, why can't they see that it's the fact that they make it so, it's everyone who watches it, there's something in there for them. Like, I think that's what other films really miss. It's like you said, Tony, it's about this world building that no one else seems to do. Yeah, I would definitely, even if you haven't got kids, just go watch this. It's just, it's nice. It's nice to watch a film that's not people getting their heads chopped off.
Stuff like that. It's got, funnily enough, because I went with my girlfriend up for her birthday, actually. It was a Monday, it was on her birthday. And one of the things she said is that it's got a really, really good message for children. A really positive message about, you know, about how people should behave and how they should see the world. And I agree. I think it's a very, very good film for that, because it will give a lot of positivity to kids when a lot of everything around them is all negative. So I think it's a very good film, a very important film for kids to see. Also, on July 24th, was released a much smaller film starring a much bigger star, which was Maggie.
Dad, you've protected me all my life. Now it's my turn to protect you. There is life with you, not with me. Don't come looking for me. I'm safe. I'm fine.
Mr. Vogel, I wouldn't normally release someone with this type of infection.
Maggie was about a teenage girl in the Midwest who becomes infected by an outbreak of a disease that slowly turns basically the population into kind of cannibalistic zombies, but it's a very slow process. It's not the typical kind of quickfire zombie turns that we see in the Walking Dead or World War Z or anything like that. It's a very slow burn. It's over a number of days they basically die, and they lose their humanity and become this cannibalistic animal that we know. And the whole film itself is very slow, and I don't mean that as a criticism, and it is quite intimate, and it's about the relationship between Arnold Schwarzenegger and Abigail Breslin, who plays his on-screen daughter, who becomes infected. And it's about the decision that ultimately he's got to make. You know, he knows what is happening to her, and he knows that soon he is going to have to put her down, effectively. And it's about the intimacy of their relationship, and about, it's not about hordes of zombies coming past the house, and we don't even see how she becomes necessarily infected. It's kind of suggested it through kind of flashbacks, but we don't get this big gory kind of sequence where we physically see her become infected. It's kind of that's not what the film's about, and it's almost not about zombieism at all. It's not about that. It is simply about the relationship between these two characters, and I won't spoil the ending, but that kind of personifies it. It's about their relationship, even this illness can't drive them apart. In some cases, you'd be terrified, to know this is happening to somebody you love. You could potentially push them away, but Arnold Schwarzenegger is completely in love with her. He's his everything. He even potentially loses his on-screen wife over it, Jolie Richardson, who's kind of famous for Nip Tuck and among other things. But basically, she leaves at a point during the film because she can't handle what's happening. It's not her daughter, that is Abigail Breslin's stepmother, but she can't handle. She loves her stepdaughter, not maybe as much as Arnie's character, but she has obviously this affection for her as well. She's been her stepmother and the mother figure for her for a number of years. We don't never see her actual biological mum, so she has this love for her as well, but she can't handle what's happening and leaves. Whereas Arnie sticks it out until the very end. And if you want to see something different, if you want to see something that's not a typical zombie movie, which is kind of what I originally went into it. I thought, oh, it's a zombie movie. I love zombie movies. I'm a big fan of the Walking Dead series. So, but it wasn't what I was expecting at all. But that's not a bad thing.
It makes an interesting change, doesn't it? In a world of things like World War Z and like you say, The Walking Dead, and now Fear the Walking Dead, and all these things, to have something that's a bit of a different approach. And with someone like Arnie in as well, that is,
he gives a very good performance. You forget with Arnie that actually he can act. He's not all I'll be back and catchphrases and action sequences. He is an actor underneath it all, and he's limited, but he can be impressive. And Abigail Breslin as well. I remember her in Little Miss Sunshine, I think she was, in Back Along. So to kind of see her, pretty much all grown up, it's nice to see. And, she's very, very good in the role as well.
Yeah, I remember her in Signs going back in time.
Yeah, that's a long
time.
She
was very little. Well, that's good. Yeah, that's one potentially to check out when it hits the online on demand. Moving on, we're back to the much more blockbustery, and this is probably the biggest blockbuster realistically of this summer period. July 31st saw the release of the fifth Impossible Mission Impossible Rogue Nation.
The IMF is uniquely trained and highly motivated. Specialist without equal, immune to any countermeasures. But it is an agency of chaos.
The time has come to dissolve the IMF.
Now, I want you to choose your next words very carefully. Where is Hunt?
Last I heard, he was tracking the syndicate.
How come the CIA has never discovered any intel regarding the syndicate?
Do you want the polite answer or the truth?
We've never met before, right?
Now, this one, obviously, love him or hate him, Tom Cruise. I quite like him, actually. he's completely bonkers. And what he talks about personally is absolute bobbins. But, he's good. He's good in this role. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, I've never been a big Cruise fan. I find him irritating. And, a lot of the films that I see him in, I go, this would be so much better without Tom Cruise. and I would argue that the first three Mission Impossible films aren't great films. They're okay, but they're alongside big mammoths like the Bourne series and the Bond franchise, obviously, which were releasing very similar but better material back in the 90s and early 2000s. But I personally think they turned the corner with Ghost Protocol, and this one is even better. You know, they've done a really good job at kind of creating Team IMF, as it were, and not just using it as an opportunity for Tom Cruise to showboat how daring he is, because, you know, obviously we know he does pretty much all his own stunts. So
yeah, he's mental.
Like the plane, that takes off. We see it in the trailer, and obviously, you know, in the film, he's actually physically being strapped to the side of a plane. It's just crazy.
Well, they were talking about that. One of the biggest shocks of that film is that's in the first 5 minutes.
I fully
thought from the trailers that was your climax. I was really surprised, pleasantly surprised, to find that was at the very beginning. Hell of a way to open the film. And they were talking about how he was at such a velocity and at such a speed that if a piece of stone had hit him, it would have been at the equivalent of a bullet, and he would have died.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, even with certain safety equipment, he's proper mad, you know, quite brave as well. But I'll take issue on one point there. I think the only weak Mission Impossible film is Mission Impossible 2, which was directed by John Woo, where basically they tried to make Ethan Hunt into a quite a wanky American James Bond, really, spliced with Hong Kong action cinema, and it didn't work. And it was a very subpar kind of sequel. The first one, you talk about the team element, and that is something that Rogue Nation has. It really brings that all together and kind of coalesces the first, well, all the films, really. There's throughout Rogue Nation, there are references to pretty much every single of the last four films.
Yeah.
But the first one was all about inverting the idea, you know, the 60s idea of this Mission Impossible force who are masters of disguise, can do all these things. The idea was that it inverted the whole thing. So you had the head of the IMF team be the villain, obviously. And I personally think that's a really sort of interesting, quite underrated thriller, the first one. It's still my favourite, actually. But the second one, like I said, rubbish on the whole. The third one was basically Alias the movie. You know, if you've seen Alias the TV show, it really was that. I mean, it even began in exactly the same way as the Alias pilot. So, and it had touched on very, very similar themes about, you know, a spy having to lie to the woman he loves to protect her from what he really does, and a villain who's got a massive MacGuffin that you never quite know what it is. Mission Impossible 3 isn't perfect, but it's very good in places, and the late Philip Seymour Hoffman is fucking terrifying as a villain. He's really good because he's so callous.
Yeah.
So that one I've really got a lot of time for. The fourth one is really good after a bit of a wobbly first 20 minutes where it's a bit drags a little bit. It really kicks in then, and it's got some fantastic sequences, and Ghost Protocol is really the one that sets the tone for Rogue Nation and tees it up, really. In fact, I'll rewatch Ghost Protocol after this, and at the very end there's a direct reference to the Syndicate, who are the villains in this film.
Yeah.
So they were literally teeing this up from then, and you didn't really quite realise until afterwards. But I think what Rogue Nation does very well is even though Tom Cruise headlines it, it does feel like an ensemble in many ways. You know, Simon Pegg gets a lot to do. Rebecca Ferguson as Ilsa, who's the femme fatale, is she a villain? Is she a good guy, good girl? She's fantastic.
She
steals the film, and she's bursts out of nowhere as a star of the future. And it's got a really... You can tell Christopher McQuarrie wrote and directed this because it's got that same twisty-turny sense of narrative in that it really does have the most complicated story without being too dense, really. I think the only thing with it, and it's got some fantastic action sequences, the whole sequence involving the going underwater into that tank where they have to go and get that data disc is superbly done.
I think the whole Opera House sequence is quite spectacular as well.
That too. They're really well. They're put together like a Swiss watch. But I think you can only see the join in the final climax because they reshot that. Originally, the way it was scripted was something very different, and I think it was much more of an action beat. But they thought that didn't work, so they shut down production for a few weeks, and then they went back and retooled it. And it got one of those endings that is... It's not completely let's explain the plot like I saw in The World's End when I watched that recently, which was awful for that. It just explained the whole plot at the end and talks the villain to death. But this has that whole let's explain what's going on while also doing a bit of a switcheroo and a twisty thing. And it's good. It's quite clever, even if it makes the villain a bit dumb. But it just doesn't quite connect, I don't think, with the rest of the film. So that was for me where it just fell down a little bit. But on the whole, really well done.
I go back to kind of what you said about the first and the third one being good films. I'm not saying they weren't good films, but arguably they weren't doing anything really that Bond and Bourne weren't already doing better. And I argue it in the article that I wrote for the site that it's the ensemble that makes now this franchise stand out and make it different. And it works so well with, you know, the likes of Simon Pegg and Jeremy Renner, who become so recognisable for other roles even. And it takes the spotlight off Tom Cruise slightly. So for those that don't necessarily like him, they can enjoy it a little bit more. Whereas the first three films were just him showboating and showing off. And the first film practically is just him solo because, you know, spoiler alert, the team obviously is disbanded and basically pretty much all killed off. And these last two films has set up this team really, really nicely. That it's almost... It's almost a bit more like, you know, Spooks or kind of those kind of ensemble type TV shows where it's about a team kind of doing missions and being spies and stuff. It's not just about that one character. But obviously, at the end of the day, it's still all about Ethan Hunt wins.
Well, I think ultimately what will happen is when Tom Cruise does get a bit too old for this, and I think he's definitely got one more in him, and possibly two, if they film them relatively swift, because he's, what 50, 51? He's got a couple more in him, I think, because for his age, he's ridiculously in good shape. But no, he's definitely got a couple of more films in him. And I think that once he does bow out, they will reboot the franchise. And I personally think that they will go back to the original team from the 60s, which is people like Jim Phelps, Barney, Collier, Rolling Hand, all the original 60s characters, a lot of whom we've not seen in the movies because they reinvented the whole thing. I think you will find that they will go back to that. And someone like George Clooney as an old Jim Phelps would be great as the lead guy. So yeah. I think fully that's what they'll do. I don't think all these characters will go on with Jeremy Renner in the lead or nothing like that. I think it will reboot without Tom Cruise. But I think Rogue Nation is really, really good entertainment. And it tees it up for a potentially really cool, really good sixth and seventh films. It's built up now. This franchise is consistently good at what it does, and it's got its ducks in a row. And I think it can go from strength to strength. Really,
its weakness is losing its women, not holding onto them in the same way it's been able to hold on to the men. You know, Ving Rhames has been, you know, alongside Tom Cruise practically all the way through, with the exception of Ghost Protocol. And obviously, Simon Pegg now is on his third film, and Jeremy Renner on his second. Other than Michelle Monaghan popping up for a cameo at the end of Ghost Protocol, obviously no other woman has actually appeared in more than one film.
No, I think that's a good point, but I think one of the big problems they've done is they haven't really cast particularly engaging leading ladies. Go on.
Can't let them near Tom Cruise because he'll Scientology them with his eyes and marry them. And he's scary Scientology babies who will take over the world.
Yeah, maybe they do one film, and I'm like, no, it's fine. He won't be as bad as they say he is. And then they're like, no, he's and fucking he nuts.
Keep him the fuck away from me, like, seriously. He's got, like, oh, no, I just can't even deal with it. I don't even want to talk about it. I'm upset.
If Rebecca Ferguson doesn't come back for the next film, you know we're right.
yeah, definitely, because they would be mad not to bring her back. So yeah, that was a good blockbuster. Moving on to August the 7th, and two less successful ones. In fact, these are probably the two big duds of the year, one of them especially of the year. Let's start with one you particularly didn't like, Dan, which was Pixels.
Incoming! Donkey Kong.
Just a barrel. How bad can it hurt?
The only way to take down Pac-Man is with ghosts.
You want ghosts?
These are your ghosts.
Oh, yeah!
We're the only ones who can do this!
I'm kidding. We are all gonna die.
Yeah, Pixels has potentially an excellent premise, and it should be good fun, and, you know, Pac-Man and Donkey Kong and fucking Peter Dinklage, it, you know, it has all the makings to be a great film.
Who's fucking Peter Dinklage? That's a fucked up film, Dan.
Yeah. It's even got Sean Bean in for like...
Does he die?
No, he doesn't, actually.
Oh, rubbish.
Gutted.
Straight away. But it's got a, you know, reasonably good cast, you know, Adam Sandler and Kevin James aside. You know, Brian Cox pops up, Sean Bean, Jane Krakowski. I don't think he even says anything. She
sorry,
just stands
sorry.
There.
Are you aware of what you just said? Brian Cox pops up at Sean Bean. Sorry, I couldn't help
you
that.
You two are so mature. At least we heard you slapping the chair then.
Sorry, it had to be done. Carry on, Dan.
Yeah, so potentially it's got, you know, the makings to be a great film. And for ages, I thought Chris Pratt was in it. And I thought, oh, yeah, another Chris Pratt outing. You know, this, you know what to expect from Chris Pratt now. You know, it would be pretty solid. And then I imagine how disappointed I was when the first thing that pops up is that it's a Happy Gilmore film. I'm like, oh, for fuck's sake, this is an Adam Sandler, isn't it? And it doesn't disappoint. It's bloody awful. There is potentially one good sequence in the whole film, and that's because Pac-Man is bloody amazing. And otherwise, it's just Adam Sandler and Kevin James playing exactly the same character that they've been playing for the last 10 years. And it's outdated, and the humour's crass and immature. It's very unmarketable in the fact that it's a 12A, but it's realistically a kid's film. But then the humour is perhaps too adult at times, and there would be storylines there that wouldn't hold their attention. But then adults will be sitting through going, what the fuck am I watching? This is a pile of crap. Teenagers would equally not find the humour particularly funny because, well, I say teenagers wouldn't. 13-year-old boys probably would find it, you know, funny, but then they probably still think that Dodgeball is a good film. And it just doesn't work, really. And it's a shame because it had such a good premise going into it. You know, there are members of the cast there that, you know, have the potential to do good things. And obviously Peter Dinklage is great in Game of Thrones and, well, basically anything he's in, and he is good in this, but it's just let down by the fact that it's such a poor product overall.
It's directed by Chris Columbus, who did Home Alone and was involved in writing things like The Goonies and stuff. And one of the things he said when he was interviewed was he wanted to make something, because he started with Amblin Entertainment, obviously, you know, which was Spielberg, so he's a mentee of him. And one of the things he wanted to do was create a film that he would have enjoyed in the 80s. Now, whether it's one of those films that would have... I mean, it probably would have worked better in the 80s because it's dealing with a lot of things that are clearly retro now. And that's obviously the whole point. But you've got that whole disconnect, by the sound of it, of, you know, kids who don't really give a shit about Donkey Kong anymore. So they're not going to particularly bother.
It's if they even know who he is.
Right.
You know, they might know who Pac-Man is, but, you know, they probably wouldn't. You know,
but these are kids who have grown up with, you know, they've grown up with Mario and things like that, but they've grown up with you know, Half-Life and Mass Effect and all this kind of thing, and Halo. They've not grown up with this.
So FIFA, obviously.
FIFA, yeah. If you're British. So you're dealing with, you know, that kind of thing, but then you've also got the adults who, you know, most of them with a right mind will be turned off by Adam Sandler being Adam Sandler, as usual. It just sounds like one of those things that's just really sort of... one of those films that they probably really, really enjoyed making, but nobody will enjoy watching. You know what I mean?
Mm. They didn't even look like they were enjoying themselves. You know, that's what's even worse, is that they look like they're fed up of making this crap. And Michelle Monaghan is sitting there wondering what the hell she's doing. I don't think she's built up quite a strong enough reputation to not take this film, but she's capable of so much better. You know, she was great in Source Code, and yeah, she was, you know, good in Mission Impossible 3, and you know, there's a number of other films that she's been in that I, you know, really liked her in, and I've always really liked her.
Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, she was
yeah,
that. She was,
yeah, but you know, you just wonder what the hell she was thinking when she signed up to do this. So it can only be that she was paid
well.
Yeah, she was paid a hell of a lot of money.
Well, yeah, I think that's one that will be quickly forgotten. One that isn't going to be so quickly forgotten, though, is the next one, which is a surprise, I think, to a lot of people in how poor this was. The reboot of Fantastic Four.
Dr. Storm, we gave you 6 years and millions of dollars, and you gave us nothing. What's different now?
Reed Richards. He wills answers to questions we don't even know to ask yet. This is our chance to learn more about our planet and maybe even save it.
I want you to meet my daughter, Sue.
You want to be famous?
I just want my work to make a difference.
John, Reed.
This guy doesn't take orders well.
Yeah, especially from people who say, I don't take orders well.
Don't let any of these lab coats give you any crap, all right?
Well, if I do, I know who to call. The Muscle.
I gotta say, it's fun having you here.
Really?
No.
Now, Emma, I know you haven't seen this yet, have you?
When I was on last time, I was saying how I knew it was going to be shit. I just knew it was going to be shit. Because whenever they go in and reshoot stuff, you kind of already got a bad feeling about it. Mm. And I was like, I'll watch it anyway because I love Marvel and I love superhero films and I really like the original two Fantastic Four films. But then the reviews started coming out and they were so, so bad. And I had the opportunity to go see it and I was like, I'd rather just stay in and take my painkillers and be in pain than go to the pictures and see it. Because I kind of don't want to see it and admit how bad it really is. I don't know. I don't understand why it's so hard to get the Fantastic Four right. I mean, it's an ensemble. They've done it with Avengers, so why can't they do it with this?
It's a ready-made ensemble.
I just don't understand, and it pisses me off. And the cast seemed really good. I mean, the cast is a lot better than last time, you know, just around us.
Well, what with this one, what's interesting is that nobody quite knows yet who's responsible for what ultimately this is. It's not a good film. It's not a terrible, terrible film. It's not one of those films that's so bad it makes you want to bleed, right?
Yeah.
Or it's so bad, in fact, that you need to watch it and enjoy it, right?
But yeah. Well, that's the thing, is everyone's like, oh, it's one of the, you know, it's the fourth worst film of all time.
No,
I'm like, no, it's not. It's not even the worst, you know, comic book movie ever. Like,
no.
You know, for fuck's sake, Halle Berry's Catwoman was atrocious.
Yeah.
You know,
it's not
that's
nearly
an awful
that.
Film.
Yeah, it is. It's not nearly as bad as anything like that. Right, the problem is it's painfully average, and that if anything, that's worse. I'd rather watch something horrid like Catwoman, because at least you can go, oh my god. With this, I was sitting there going, oh, I'm just so bored. It just doesn't work at all. I mean, it's amazing how much it doesn't work. Really,
it's just a bit upsetting. If anything else, you know, you're just like, oh, Kate Mara is so much better than this. Like, you know, sort your fucking wig out and, you know, start acting. You know.
Well, yeah, but there's two things with that. A, he didn't want to cast her, Josh Trank, who directed it.
No.
Right? He didn't want Kate Mara, and apparently he treated her like crap all the way through, right?
Yeah, she looked miserable, didn't she?
Right, yeah. B, if you believe the stories, B, the wig is a consequence of the fact that they basically reshot the entire ending, and the ending is just the first like half, or at least, of the film is this sort of much darker build towards, you know, and you know, the ideas in it are quite good, you know, using like parallel dimension where they get their powers and exploring, like, you know, this kind of grungy tech that Reed Richards has created and all this, and that there's nothing wrong with that. And there's one bit particularly that betrays the fact that Josh Trank wanted to make a Cronenberg style body horror film as a superhero movie, and there's a couple of sequences where that does happen. There's one where they first come back and Reed is stretched out and you've got Johnny Storm on fire. And it's quite unnerving. And you think, oh,
yeah,
this is... And that's a better film. Problem is that when you get to the end and Victor Von Doom unleashes himself as the villain, it's just your classic kind of superhero bollocks and not very well done superhero bollocks. And you're thinking, well, how did this happen? And the reason it happened is they who knows, right?
They got a makeshift team. I think it was Matthew Vaughn was one of them. Basically, there was a Fox called upon three, you know, their directors that are on their payroll, basically, to come, you know, hash together some second half of the film. And it's bloody obvious when it happens as well, because the style and tone completely change. It just doesn't work. And what Josh Trank was doing, you know, whether, you know, I've heard some people say, and that working in cinema, you get mixed reviews from it. That people go, oh, yeah, the first hour of the film was really boring. Nothing really happens. But for me, that was so much better. There was a lot more going on. Yeah. It's all the, mindless gun-toting kind of bang-bang Michael Bay-loving idiots that, loved the second half. I say loved, that's a strong word, but, preferred, shall we say, the second half of the film, which was just utter crap. So, for example, you've got Ben Grimm for one moment bloody hates, his guts, and then all of a sudden, 2 seconds later, they're best mates again.
Yeah.
And, they're joking about Fantastic Four, jokes, and it's just not good.
I think what's tainted it really is that all the behind the scenes stuff of how apparently Josh Trank was kicked off, and then there's people who are saying that no, he was involved in the cut, and he had ultimately has to take full responsibility for this.
Mm.
You've then got the whole thing of were all the actors properly cast? For me, the only one who was cast well was Michael B. Jordan. I think all the rest were miscast to a various degree. Jamie Bell was okay, but I think Miles Teller's just not right for Reed Richards. He doesn't have that leading man charisma yet. Right, he's a good actor. I'm not taking nothing away from his acting. Whiplash proved that, but he's not got that. He's just a bit too smug. You want to punch his face in, and that's not what you need from Reed. Kate Mara is just a bit dull, really, as an actress. A sister would have been much better. And then when you get to the very end, and without spoiling anything, the end is them all lined up, ready for a sequel, where they're all going, we're fantastic. And you're thinking, no, you're not, because A, this film isn't fantastic, and B, I don't believe you believe this in the first place. And I was sitting there thinking, this is just, this doesn't work, I know this doesn't work, let's all be honest about this, let's stop pretending, right? I was like, stop pretending. All right, we know this hasn't worked, we know it's a failure, give it back to Marvel, for goodness sake.
Do you reckon there's some potential Marvel Disney deal on the horizon? Because that building at the end looks suspiciously like the same building that the Avengers are currently using.
I think there's too much raw nerve at this point right now. I think there's just too many wounds that are open. They're still being bullish and saying, we're going to do a sequel, we believe in this. They're basically just trying to save face. The reality is that whole sequel thing will quietly die off, right? Yeah. And well, then in a couple of years, they will make a deal, or they will just let the rights revert very quietly. Yeah. And, I will believe the sequel when I see it.
Just Fox are just very stubborn. There's a lot of kind of rumours that they just made this film just for the sake of it. They actually didn't care how bad or, rushed it actually was, and it's part of the reason Josh Trank was kind of hired in the first place. The fact that actually they just didn't want to lose the rights.
Yeah, I think there's truth in that. I would imagine there's a lot of truth in that. They didn't want to lose face and admit that, because somebody needs to get this right. A friend of mine who I used to, in fact, be one of my housemate. He's a burgeoning TV writer, and he said that the best way to do this would be to make it a Netflix Marvel show, and have a very sort of Doctor Who style, bright and breezy family adventure show with the Fantastic Four. Make it a TV series, and I think he's spot on. I think that would be much, much better, and they'd be able to get this tonally right instead of it being. I know a lot of people retrospectively have said they liked the first two Fantastic Fours. I still don't, but tonally I think they're more what it should be, definitely. I think it's more in line with, and I'm not an expert by any means, but I think it's more in line with what it should be. Dark Fantastic Four, yeah, I know they've done that in the comics, but it's like when you try and darken Spider-Man. It doesn't work in the same way. The new Spider-Man will be really good because he's just going to be a mouthy little kid. That is why it will probably be the best one, I think.
Yeah, the thing is obviously, there are people, as I already said, that are being overly harsh on it. It's not the worst film of all time.
No.
To say that is incredibly insulting to the people that are involved, because they know it's not good, but they also know it's not that bad. At the end of the day, this was partly made with the obsession with that's kind of come along since Christopher Nolan's Batman films, is that everything's got to now be dark and gritty and serious, and it won't work and won't be a proper film unless it is, because if it's too light and fluffy like the originals were, then it's going to get panned by critics. And unfortunately, they did the opposite, and exactly that still happened.
Yeah, exactly. It's a shame, but let's wait and see what happens with this one. I think eventually it will quietly go back to Marvel, and they will integrate it well or do it right, whatever. Let's move on. Dan, you've got the box office figures, haven't you, for the summer? Because it will look very different from where we were last.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Yeah, I do. This is August 28th to the 30th in the UK. Number 10 is a little-known film called 45 Years, which is very popular with the grey audience.
I would like to see that, though, because that's got some good actors. Tom Courtney, Charlotte Rampling.
Yes. Yeah, some very, very good actors in it.
It'll be good, that.
Basically, long story short, basically about the kind of challenges of marriage and about this couple that have reached 45 years of marriage and about their struggles and about their relationship, etc., and where they kind of go from there. It's a new release last weekend, so number 10 taken just under £500,000, which isn't bad. Number 9, it's been around for 10 weeks now. It's DreamWorks' Minions, which still took £353,000, and it's taken a total of £45 million in the UK alone, which is incredible.
I'm not surprised.
Number 8, review coming up a bit shortly. Paper Towns with Cara Devine in the cast, a little kind of teen rom com, taken £3.5 million. In overall. 7 is the horror sequel that no one really wanted to see, Sinister 2.
I don't think anyone did see it, did they?
No, but it did take just over £500,000 in its second week, so taking about £2.5 million overall, so not too shabby, because as are most horror films, I suspect it was made on a shoestring. Number 6, a review also coming up for this one, The Man from U.N.C.L.E. Which has taken just over £5 million now in its third week. No doubt will hang around for a few more weeks yet. We've just absolutely ripped it apart. Adam Sandler's Pixels is at number 5. That one, believe it or not, is actually up one place on last week. So for some reason, Pixels and Man from U.N.C.L.E. have switched. I can only imagine that is kind of last of the summer holiday rush, all the kids going, what the hell can we take the kids to now? Well, there's this little known film called Pixels that you can go see. At number 4, we reviewed it earlier, to much high praise, Mission Impossible Rogue Nation.
Hey.
Took just under 900,000 in its fifth week, so taking a total of £18 million in the UK. Number 3 review coming up, it was new out that weekend, it was Hitman Agent 47. Believe it or not, took just under £1 million, but this is week one, so you'd expect it to at least take $1 million, or you would hope it would anyway.
Drop like a stone.
It will. And number 2, Pixar's Inside Out, which we unanimously loved. Over £33 million in week 6. That will probably hang around throughout September, probably October. If it's anything like Minions, it'll probably still be there at bloody Christmas. And at number 1, We've got a written review coming up with it from Mr. Matt Latham. It's Straight Outta Compton, which took £2.5 million in week one. So that's the box office top 10.
It will. Straight Outta Compton will has done a very good business in America, and it will. I'm not surprised. It makes a lot of sense. As we say, Matt Latham has done a written review of that for us. He couldn't be here today. He's busy. He's done a written review, which is good. He'll be giving his thoughts. That will be going live on the Black Hole Online blog very shortly. So keep an eye out for that. Okay, moving slightly back then from that was the current box office. We're going to go back in time and talk about August 14th. So we're right smack bang in the middle now. And that week, the big release was The Man from U.N.C.L.E.
Are they still following us?
Yes.
Is there one of them? Is he looking at us? Does he have just one hand on the steering wheel? When you hear something that sounds like a gunshot, drive.
So, yeah, this was an adaptation of the 1960s TV show, which starred Robert Vaughn and David McCallum. A bit forgotten, really. It's not really been on much on, like, ITV2. Not as much as The Saint and, you know, things like that. And The Avengers, which are much better remembered. But it was quite a fun idea. It was, you know, it's at the height of the Cold War. An agent of America, of an American intelligence agency, and an agent of the KGB have to come together to work for a bigger sort of multi-spanning agency called U.N.C.L.E. to fight, you know, some bonkers stuff. The TV show had them fighting robots and all kinds of mad shit. But it was from what I saw as a kid, it was fun. And this is fun. It's one of those films, The Man from U.N.C.L.E., that is deep as a puddle. It's classic Guy Ritchie in that it's all style, sleekness, charm, cheekiness. But it's enjoyable, you know. It's fun. It's a good ride. It surprised me because I don't particularly find Henry Cavill a much of an actor. He hasn't convinced me as Superman yet particularly. I find him quite dull. Armie Hammer. I know he's a decent actor, but I never quite got him either. But they were really good in this. Cavill as Napoleon Solo, who's the, you know, the charming, stylish American based.
Napoleon Solo.
That's his name, Napoleon Solo. This was before the days of Han Solo.
And only in Hollywood do they cast a Brit as an American and an American as a Russian.
Right, yeah, it's a bit mad, but he's really good, Cavill, because he's basically playing James Bond in the '60s. Just American. He really is. It's that whole, that literally at one point a chambermaid comes in his posh hotel in wherever, in Rome, and says, is there anything else I can do for you? And he looks over his paper and goes, what time do you finish? It's that kind of thing. It's that
classic. That's horrible.
I know, and she just closes the door then and stays with it. It's not as sleazy as I'm making it sound. It's actually quite funny. And that kind of old James Bond kind of, can I help you, Mr. Bond? And he's like, well, I'm sure I can think of something. You know, that kind of thing. it's done very much with a wink and a nod. And then Armie Hammer is the opposite, because he's the very taciturn, angry, serious beast of a Russian. He finds things very important. And then you've got Solo just being, you know, Ilya Kuryakin, his name is. And he's just there going, hey, man, just chill out. Have a martini. And he's like, no, I cannot. I have mission and all that. So it's quite funny because they're butting heads all the way through, because they're complete opposites. And in the middle, you've got Alicia Vikander, who's this quite tomboyish but obviously very cute love interest. Sort of just she's also the plot MacGuffin, really.
I will just say about Vikander, she is really standing out as an incredible actress. She's got, I think, such a bright future ahead of her. You know, from Ex Machina earlier on in the year, to
Danish Girl,
which the Danish Girl with Eddie Redmayne and herself, which the trailer kind of dropped earlier on in the week. And that's incredible. That looks incredible, and you know, I hope she's at least bloody nominated for an Academy Award, because she's had a fantastic start. Because she's come from nowhere, completely out of nowhere.
She's got a lot of promise. She's been quite canny with what she's choosing. She's also been Bourne 5. She's in the next Bourne film.
Yeah.
She's been quite clever with what she does. And, you know, she's getting that balance right. And she's perfectly good in this.
Now, she's working her socks off.
She's in everything. She's doing really well. And then you've got an actress called Elizabeth Debicki, who I wasn't familiar with before, as playing the villainess. And she's like this evil British contessa who's like rich. And she's great because she's really sort of ice maiden cold. And some of the lines, like she at one point, she ends up seducing Solo. And then she has him captured. Because the whole story, don't worry about the story. The story's bobbins. It's all like, you know, old Nazis trying to do nuclear weapons and all this. Don't worry about that. They don't care about the story. You don't have to worry either. But at one point, they capture Solo. And she's there. And she goes, I've got to go. And she says, I'm so sorry, I can't finish you off myself. And it's things like, it's little lines like that, where you're just going, it's just really funny. And then it just, it's very much Guy Ritchie in that it knows how silly it is. It knows how winky it is to, like, Bond of old and old spy capers, like, you know, Airman Flint and all this kind of stuff. And it just enjoys. It's having fun, and you have fun with it. It's a bit baggy, it's a bit too long. The plot isn't much. There isn't much of a plot, really. But it doesn't matter, because you're having fun with the characters. And I think Cavill and Hammer, I hope they do a sequel. I imagine they will. It tees up perfectly for a sequel. And it's just a laugh. It's a good laugh. And it's not the best film of the summer, but it's definitely one I'd recommend. Next up, Dan, you saw another that week. Absolutely Anything.
By the power invested in me by the Intergalactic Council, I hereby pronounce a destruction order on the planet Earth. The usual test, Kylie.
One Earthling will be picked at random.
To prove he can use absolute power for good.
But if he uses it for evil,
the Earth will be eliminated.
Suppose there was one thing you could do that would change your life for the better.
Oh, that's easy. I would be able to see Catherine from downstairs.
I can make things happen.
Clothes? Get dressed on me.
All I have to do is wave my hand.
Dennis, be able to speak.
Biscuits.
What?
Biscuits. Please, please, please. Nothing else matters.
Come to think of it, I wouldn't mind shagging your leg right now.
Yes, the final film for Robin Williams. He plays the voice of Dennis the Dog alongside the beautiful Kate Beckinsale and Simon Pegg. It's a very short little film, 85 minutes overall. You've also got the voices of the guys from Monty Python playing the intelligent alien life force that basically test the human race, you know, whether they survive or not, by giving Simon Pegg's character, I'm trying to forget, I think of his name now, Neil Clark, basically they give him the power of anything. So with a wave of his hand, anything will happen. So, you know, give me the body of a good man, and it turns into Albert Einstein, obviously. And then it's all little gags about that, where, you know, if he's not specific enough, then something he, you know, doesn't want to happen happens. And you know, it's a chuckle. It's not like kind of, you know, laugh your belly off, your ribs hurt afterwards, you know. But it's silly. It knows exactly what it is. You know, it doesn't pretend it's intelligent or, you know, thought-provoking. It just kind of is what it is. You know, foresight, Robin Williams probably would have liked to have been remembered for a more impressive final film. But you know, if you want something light and, you know, that you can just go along and laugh to, then it's perfectly fine for that. It's not thought-provoking in the way that it perhaps could have been. But, you know, Simon Pegg puts in kind of a delightfully British performance, and as I said, Kate Beckinsale was just, you know, stunning in it. And you know, there's some nice little, you know, kind of pop-ups and cameos and from a, you know, big kind of familiar British cast. Eddie Izzard, Joanna Lumley pops up, and as I said, obviously the voices of Monty Python, John Cleese, etc. Mira Sahal pops up a couple of times. Michael Palin, you know, it's you know, full of you know, familiar faces that Brits are going to be able to identify.
Well, it's by Terry Jones, isn't it? Terry Jones is the director, so it's Python in, you know, at its heart. It's Python at its heart.
Yeah, kind of. It's, the kind of critics have kind of said it's have some Monty Python sketch that's a little bit too long, but yeah. You know, as it runs at 85 minutes, you know, it's banging, you're out, you know, it's shorter than most kids' films nowadays. So yeah. If you just want, you know, you've got a spare hour and a half, just go along and just have a little laugh.
Fair enough. Speaking of laughs, the week after was a comedy, which August 21st, which saw the rising star of Amy Schumer appear in Trainwreck.
Girls, your mother and I are getting divorced. Monogamy isn't realistic.
Monogamy isn't realistic.
Again.
Monogamy isn't realistic.
I didn't understand that word at the time. But now I know exactly what he was talking about.
Saturday, I would love it if you were my date.
I can't do that because, like, you and I won't ever see each other again.
I wake up late every morning, my head just cooling, I'm still yawning. Oh,
morning.
Oh, Amy, what happened? Did church let out early?
Ooh, I like Tom's sweater. Does he teach computer in a church basement? Don't get all threatened just because you don't understand the concept of marriage. You dress him like that so nobody else wants to have sex with him. That's cool.
Hey!
Now, you saw this one, Emma, didn't you?
Yeah. So, Amy Schumer plays Amy, who is...
Inventive.
So clever. She is the aforementioned train wreck, and she drinks, and she sleeps around, and she's doing all the things men do, but it's trying to, obviously, she's, you know...
How sexist.
you know what it's trying to do straight away? Like, it's trying to take away that kind of, I think, slut-shaming element that comes across when a woman is in film and she sleeps around and she drinks a lot. And John Cena's in it, because obviously I watch him every week on The Wrestling and his character was so different. I think it loses a bit of itself about... When she, like, gets into the relationship with Bill Hader, it kind of loses its way, and then it turns into, like, a really typical rom-com. Like, she changes her ways for the man she loves and all that kind of thing. And I think I would have enjoyed it more if the relationship hadn't worked and it kind of been like, some people aren't meant to be in a relationship. Some people, you don't have to be in a relationship to be happy, and not everyone needs fixing. And I kind of don't feel like they set out to kind of end it in that way or to tell that kind of story, but that's what definitely came across for me. Like, something happens and they break up, and she does something, and then, like, her sister's like, you have to change your ways. So she, like, gets rid of all her booze and she starts working really hard. And I was a bit like, well, why did she have to do that? I understand it's called train wreck and stuff, but I kind of felt like it just went back to the age old thing of, oh, no man's gonna want you if you've had this past, no man's ever gonna want you. I was really kind of disappointed in it in that way, because I would prefer it if she had sat Bill Hader down and just gone, do you know what, I can't be in a relationship, it doesn't work for me, I know what works for me, and that's okay. I thought that would have been not more empowering, but just more interesting. And yeah. I didn't like how it ended, but then obviously I knew how it was going to end. I think anyone knows how it's going to end. But it is really funny. It is just a bit where, like, she's like, John Cena's kind of breaking up with her, and she's just going, I'm so high right now, I can't deal with this, can we talk about it later? And he's just like, no. And he's, like, fighting with some guy in the cinema, but he keeps making, like, really... He keeps insulting him in a homosexual way. He's like, I'm going to lick your asshole. It's like, instead of, like, saying, I'm going to take you outside, I'm going to bat you, he goes, I'll lick your asshole. It is funny. I would say, like, the first hour was really funny, but... She, like, Amy Schumer, you can kind of tell you've gone for the whole, like, bridesmaid kind of thing, and, you know, the whole, like, Kirsten Wiig and Melissa McCarthy kind of what they've got going on. But I don't know, it kind of did lose its way. And I know, like, bridesmaid, she ended up with Chris O'Dowd in the end, but I would have liked it to not end it the same way as every other fucking rom-com I've ever seen in my entire life. Just watch it for John Cena. He's in it for, like, the first 45 minutes. And I was just like, you're not John Cena. You're not the guy that my son absolutely loves every week saying those dirty things. So, but yeah, it kind of loses its way. But I think it's a good star for Amy Schumer in, like, films and stuff. But yeah, disappointing in the end. And
it's funny you say that, because of how, you know, kind of... controversial she's been. It does seem like what you're saying about the fact that it almost doesn't seem like the film that she maybe wanted to make.
Yeah.
More the ending that you kind of suggested is perhaps more what she was going for, and it might even be what they originally wrote, and then, you know, the kind of perhaps the network stepped in and goes, no, you can't do that. They've got to have their happy ending. That's how films end, you know, kind of.
I mean,
that's what the audience want.
Yeah, I don't want to turn into this big, like, you know, this debate on, like, how women are portrayed in films and all that, because that kind of shit doesn't really interest me to a certain extent anyway. But I find the way romance is portrayed, I mean, heterosexual romance, it's just the same shit all the time. Mm. And the majority of relationships, okay, you get together and it's all lovey-dovey, and then you kind of settle into this really mundane routine. Like, it happens to everyone. It's the same with Mike. I'm not saying our relationship's boring, if you listen. I'm not. But you know how, like, you kind of get into these little habits. Like, I know, like, Mike's going to come see me so many days a week, and once a month we'll go here and we'll do this. But that's just how it is. That's kind of like, that's how you want your relationship to be, I think. Mm. That's when you know you've got it together.
Yeah.
But every rom-com is like, lovey-dovey, boring, 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 drama, God, no, quick, catch her, she's on an airplane, propose, yay, marriage, she's converted. I don't know anyone seriously. I swear to God, if Mike proposed to me on top of, like, the Eiffel Tower or something, I'd push him off.
Or laugh.
I probably would.
Probably both.
Yeah. But where's the rom-com for, like, not every girl's like that. Not every girl wants to be in a relationship. Not every girl wants some guy to... I find it really uncomfortable to be, like, showered with gifts and affection, and I'm just like, oh, no, it's okay, it's cool. Where's the rom-com for people like me? Because there's more of us.
Oh, yeah, I think it's kind of outdated in the fact that, actually, it's now the opposite way around. More women are like, as you're explaining, and I think that the kind of old kind of Bridget Jones that wants her, you know, feet swept away and you know, wants to be showered with gifts and adored and worshipped, that's very old-fashioned. And I don't think most women think like that, particularly young women don't think like that these days.
In a weird way, I think more men associate with this, oddly enough. I think if you find there's a lot of women. I mean, you know, my girlfriend's exactly the same. She doesn't like fuss. She doesn't like constant soppiness. You know, she's exactly the same. And I think there's an issue. There's a thing with this, with, you know, these rom-coms. This is Judd Apatow. You know, Judd Apatow. He most of the time he caves to the you know, the saccharine in the end. You know, he gives in, especially in his more recent films. You know, the edge is definitely gone from him. He gives in the end, and he gives people happy endings. So I think that's part of the problem, really. And yeah, I think the gender stereotypes of it are very clear. And obviously it was tainted, wasn't it, because of the shootings that happened in America in a showing of Trainwreck. So, not that that is a reflection on the film in any way, but it just seems a little bit slightly misconceived.
I kind of feel like a lot of other genres are evolving. Like, we talk about, like, we did The Man from U.N.C.L.E. before in Mission Impossible, and the new Bond and Bourne. Like, the spy genre's evolved, and, you know, horror is constantly evolving and shit like that, and action's evolving, and rom-com is the fucking same as it's always been. It's just the same formula, and... Mm. Like you said, gender roles have evolved since the 1950s. Women just don't want to get married anymore, but that's all we're seeing, like, constantly, all the time. And they'll be trying to make women career women, but it's always, like, that's an issue. Oh, baby, you work so much. Oh, well, I'll sacrifice my career to keep you happy. Like, and I don't know if this is the same in films where, you know, you have a homosexual couple. Like, is that the same dynamic that they portray all the time, or is it just this? And why is it just this? It's boring as fuck. Yeah. It really is. It's just so frustrating. Like, it's 2015 now. Relationships aren't the same anymore. Mm. And even when you've got, like, Friends with Benefits with Justin Timberlake and Mila Kunis. They end up getting together. And there's going to be a film probably next year about a couple who meet on Tinder and end up getting married despite all the fact that she's swiped right and all the, like... Dating is evolving and relationships are evolving, but movies aren't evolving to reflect that at all.
Okay.
And I'm not watching another one. I'm never watching another fucking one ever again until I write it myself, and it'll be fucking awesome.
I actually think men are the more are more geared towards commitment now than ever before. You know, I've got a lot of female friends, so I'm still not going to pretend I understand women, because I do not. but I do feel like it's actually the men that want the commitment now. It's women that want to go. You know, all my female friends. You know, I don't think any of them. One is in a relationship, all the rest of them, you know, they're traveling the world and, you know, they're, you know, banging on with their career and all that. I've actually got one friend who's kind of the old fashioned. She settled down. She, you know, she met him when she was 17, 18. They've been together for years, and then now they, you know, they settled down, bought an apartment, bought a house, got engaged, got married. She's now just qualified to become a teacher, and no doubt they'll have a baby in no time. That's the kind of old-fashioned kind of way of, you know, how we view relationships, and that's how rom-coms are still kind of painting it, as it were. But that's not the women that I know.
It's not the women I know either. Like, I've got like two female friends. That's it. One of them is in a relationship, the other's recently single, and I don't think either of them have any plans to settle down anytime soon. I mean, obviously, I was the first person I knew to get married and have a child, and I was really, really quite young. And even the way, like, single mothers are portrayed in rom-coms were, like, you're portrayed as, like, the shrew, the man-hater. My kid's dad's an arsehole. But, I don't know, like, me and Mike talk about getting married and having more children, and I'll probably end up, I wouldn't be surprised if I had another baby before I was like 31. But you don't see that kind of like, and I think that's a new thing as well, like families like breaking up and forming new families with other people with other children.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's never showing, and that's what pisses me off, because especially the way single mothers are represented, I feel, in society, I feel a lot of shit from people being a single mother who lives at home with her parents and who's a scouser. Dirty scouse single mother. You know, I feel a lot of hate from society, and I think people assume that I, like, Freddie was an accident. They don't assume that I was married and, like, my marriage ended. They don't assume that I'm in a new relationship, which is really good. They just look at me and think, single mother, she must be on the dole. None of the other stuff I have done so far in my life matters to some people. All that matters is that I have a child, and I'm not married to that child's father anymore, and that is it. And we are literally looked at like scumbags, and it pisses me off.
But that movie is never going to come out of America. It's
got no, it won't.
This country, because in American society, they still paint it as the white picket fence, the perfect family. What they seem to forget is most of the husbands are unfaithful to their wives.
Yeah. Well, I think there's a crucial element with this, though, in that you've got to look at it from the way studios market films.
Mm.
And that what you've just described, Em, is true to real life. I know people myself, and it would be true in America. But it won't play well to a test audience. And they know that people won't go out to see a film that's a bit too real. The whole idea of something like Trainwreck is that it's the dream, isn't it? It's the romantic dream of a, you know, a self-empowered woman who's, you know, taking it back for herself, and then she meets a man who can, you know, convince her she wants, you know, it's that path, it's that fantasy, almost.
Whose dream is that, though? That's the question I want to ask.
Yeah. I think it's surprisingly, obviously, rom-coms are geared towards women. However, I don't believe that's the modern woman's dream. That's the man's dream.
I don't know any... The only woman I know who enjoys a rom-com is my mum, and she enjoys, like, the old-fashioned ones. I think what you were saying, Dan, is, like, a film about a single mum wouldn't be American-made. I think it would you could get British filmmakers make something, but I'm kind of worried that they'd make it really gritty, like council estate mum with three kids working hard at the chippy, like, that's not... I don't feel stereotyped often, but this makes me feel stereotyped, especially in the society we live in with, you know, the cracking down on benefits, and there's a big, like, thing in the media about people on benefits. Like, I'm on a few benefits that I get through working, but I still feel like right now society's looking at me going, stupid bitch, slag, scumbag, you know.
But it's all too close to the truth, you know, and that's why people, they struggle to laugh at something that's too close to the truth quite often. You know, if we get to a point where the benefits issue isn't the problem, you will get some kind of knockabout benefit comedy, but it won't happen while it's still something that really, really touches a raw nerve. Something like Trainwreck, which is that romantic ideal, you know, technically flipped. If you think about it in how they would imagine it in a marketing thing, oh, it's about, you know, an independent woman who's taking back the sex for herself, and she's then going to meet, you know, she's in control of all this, which is fine, nothing wrong with that at all. But the whole idea is that it may not be particularly representative to a lot of people, it'll play well, and it did play well. Obviously, not in one cinema, but it, you know, it played well, and it did fairly well. And it got Amy's. It got.
You're still gonna have to edit that out.
Yeah, I know.
Yes.
Yeah, sorry. Sorry to anyone listening. I may not even cut that. I may keep it. But it's. Yeah, it's just. To be fair, though, in fairness to Trainwreck, if it gets people having this conversation, it's done some kind of job. You know, it hasn't just completely faded.
I don't think it will. I don't think it will. I think.
People like us will sit here and
I think with comedy, especially, even if it's got a deeper meaning behind it, I don't think people are going to essentially walk away and say, we should talk about this because it's comedy and it's not meant to be taken seriously. And I get that to a certain extent. But obviously, the amount of times I've sat on here and bitched about When Harry Met Sally and all that kind of stuff, it's probably the one thing that pisses me off the most because of the situation I'm in and because of the experience I've had. But I just want someone to go out there and just make a real film about real relationships and how they really fucking work, so we can stop teaching young girls and even young boys that this is how your life's going to be and it's all going to be easy and everything's going to work out okay in the end. Because sometimes it's not. It's not, and you could well end up on your own, and that's not the worst fucking thing in the world. The worst thing in the world is to be a horrible bastard arsehole who makes other people miserable. It's not the worst thing in the world to be on your own. It's okay. So why can't we do that?
This got really deep. This is now turned into a black hole soapbox.
That's the next spin-off podcast that we'll do. Black hole soapbox. So yeah, another film
but
that came
it's
out.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks for that. It's
all right.
Yeah, another film that came out the same week was didn't quite touch us the same kind of nerve. This was Paper Towns.
The way I figure it, everyone gets a miracle. My miracle was I wound up living across the street from Margot Roth Spiegelman. She was inarguably the most gorgeous creature that God had ever created. Margot's life was a series of unbelievably epic adventures.
Are you going to spend the rest of high school pining for this girl?
As senior year drew to a close, Margot and I were practically strangers. Until this one night.
What the?
Margot?
I need to borrow your car.
What?
I have 9 things I need to do tonight.
Can't you just get your boyfriend to do it?
Ex-boyfriend.
I always keep calling paper towels. I think that's funnier.
Yeah.
Dan, you saw this, didn't you?
Paper Towns is another book adaptation from the author John Green, the YouTuber and nerd extraordinaire. Stars Nat Wolff and Cara Delevingne alongside a teenage cast of uncharismatic bastards. Which quite frankly kind of sums up the film. You know, Cara Delevingne she's quite engaging, and I'll be interested to see how she gets on with stuff like Suicide Squad and those kind of bigger properties. But Nat Wolff is the most uncharismatic male lead I've ever. He's just so fucking boring. It's kind of like it's Andrew Garfield kind of, you know, awkward teen kind of, you know. You could even, you know, you could put someone like, you know, like Andrew Garfield, or, you know, like maybe even Logan Lerman, who at least is a little bit more engaging. But Nat Wolff is so boring, it just so monotone. Even when he's trying to be funny, it just plays across as dull. And I only got through about an hour, I think, of the film before I thought, nah, I've got better things to do.
Well, yeah. Fair enough.
Yeah, the kind of synopsis of it is that basically the character of Quentin, played by Nat Wolff, has been in love with this girl for as long as he can remember. Margot, played by Cara Delevingne, who's a kind of eccentric kind of girl. You know, she's the most popular girl kind of in school, but it's also because she's different and quirky and basically kind of, after a horrendous breakup where she finds out that her boyfriend, a jock boyfriend, is cheating on her with her best friend, she basically goes on this kind of a revenge spree and then disappears. And Quentin then kind of, thinking of his dick, kind of follows her around the place and ropes in his very... They're all very strange looking as well. Cara Delevingne has got very prominent eyebrows, which she's kind of well known for. Then there's Austin Abrahams, I think it is, who plays the kind of friend, who I think has a monobrow going on for most of the film. And all of the cast just look a little bizarre. They're not quite normal looking, which maybe that's kind of part of the point. But yeah, it's just, I don't think it will hit the same kind of notes that Fault in Our Stars will. Yeah, which I, you know, I hold my hands, but I haven't seen. But I think obviously the source material of that, you know, obviously was able to strike a chord, which I don't think this remotely will. Not only that, but Fault in Our Stars had, you know, two good leads in Shailene Woodley and Ansel Elgort, I think.
Ridiculous name.
Yeah. But basically Nat Wolff seemed to have gotten promoted from playing kind of a sidekick in that film to kind of, you know, becoming the lead and, you know, unfairly in this, because he's just bloody useless. I can't see him having much of a career, if I'm honest.
Well, he looked very dull. Cara Delevingne is one of those people you know, you either like her or you don't. I think she's got something to prove yet with the acting. You know, she deserves a bit more of a chance. But yeah, I think this is one that will go down as a fairly uninteresting piece of cinema, as will the last film we'll talk about tonight, which was the last release from last weekend. Obviously, we're going to have the Straight Outta Compton written review, as I said earlier. But the film that came out alongside that was the enormously unremarkable Hitman, Agent 47.
Why don't we start with your name?
47.
That's not a name.
No, but it is mine.
What exactly are you?
An assassin.
And you're here to kill who?
You should really let me go.
The last time I checked, you're the one locked in here with me, and I'm the one with the gun.
No, Mr. Sanders. You're locked in here with me, and you just brought me mine.
Do you remember the last one? Do you remember the last Hitman with Timothy Elephant, whatever his name is?
I vaguely remember, but I didn't see it, no.
No, well, you and most other people, I think. It was one of those, it was rubbish. It was, you know, it was, the Hitman games are very good. You know, in the days I used to be a gamer, I'm not really anymore, but back in the days I played a fair few of those, and they were great fun, really good. They're all about stealth, ultimately.
Yes.
The whole idea of Hitman is that he, obviously he's a hitman, a mysterious assassin called Agent 47, who gets missions in all kinds of different places, like embassies, and he has to get in and get out, ideally without anyone knowing he was there, to take out targets that are usually ambassadors or generals or all these kind of, you know, he works for a high end assassin organization in the world called the Syndicate, and you know that's a great concept. Not to be confused with Mission Impossible, no. This film has all the subtlety of a brick tied to an anvil, thrown off a building. It is so just crushingly obvious in every way. Not terrible. In fact, it might even be slightly better than the last Hitman film, but that's damning with faint praise. It's just so obviously plodding and dull and boring. And plot is basically the hitman has to find this girl whose dad invented a bad weapon, and he has to try and kill her, but then turns out that it seems that Zachary Quinto is the saviour in this, and then he turns out to be the bad guy, and Hitman has to save her, even though it makes far more sense that the hitman, who is a pretty scary big bald dude, right, with all these skills, should, you know, in the first, funnily enough, when he's actually seems to be the villain in the first half an hour, he's much, much better. And you really get the sense that if they'd have played that for the whole film, he'd be like this Terminator-style silent killer, and it would have been much, much more entertaining. But no, they have to start exploring the man within, the unemotional, tormented clone hitman. You know, Rupert Friend, who was in stuff like The Young Victoria, Homeland. Yeah, not a bad actor.
I can't imagine him bald though.
Well, the thing is, if you put hair on him in this film, and I said this in my written review, he would make a decent candidate for the next James Bond, because there are some very, he's very good at the action stuff. I'll take nothing away from him. He comes out with a bit of dignity. But it's like, yeah, you're yawning, Emma. That's how I felt, right? It was that kind of thing. And I was just like, just one of those dull action films that offers nothing new. And I'm bored even talking about it. It's so easy to make a Hitman game. A Hitman game would be so easy to make into a movie. It boggles the mind why they can't get it right. So, yeah, don't bother. Don't bother with that. Just go and watch The Man from Uncle and have a laugh. Go and watch Mission Impossible to see how espionage really works. And then,
or Mad Max Fury Road has recently come out on DVD, so buy that.
Yes, or buy that. Buy it on Blu-ray, for goodness sake. Buy it in the best. Put it on a massive telly, put the sound up to maximum, and blow your face off. That's what you should do. But yeah, so that was the summer.
Yeah, we were kind of at a halfway point now. We kind of brought it up on Twitter, but
I thought you meant this podcast. I was like, Jesus Christ, I'm going to work tomorrow.
but where are we kind of, we kind of mentioned where we would place things already, the Inside Out potentially would be, in top threes or whatever, but, what we're thinking in terms of top threes at the moment.
Well, if you want, I'll give you a top five. Because using Letterboxd, like the film nerd I am, I actually collate my films. So, at number five, Kingsman, The Secret Absolutely. Service.
Brilliant, yeah.
Which I thought was great fun. At number four, Fast and Furious 7, and I'm not joking, because that is complete nonsense, but boy, is that entertaining, right? Is that a lot of fun? And it's either that I haven't seen the good films this year, or it's been a weak year for films, because really, that shouldn't be in my top five. No. Really. It's good, but it shouldn't be in my top five. Mm. But it is. At number three, Amy Winehouse documentary, which I really liked. I thought that was extremely good, extremely well done, and really quite powerful. Number two is Inside Out, as I've said, and number one is still Mad Max, without question. That's the best film of the year.
Yeah. My number five, probably Mission Impossible, Rogue Nation. Because I had a lot of fun watching that. I remember going into it thinking, oh, I'll be all right, but it did impress me. Number four was Inside Out. Number three was Kingsman. Number two, Mad Max. And number one, actually Whiplash, if we can kind of include that. Because obviously it's kind of on the border there, isn't it? It was released January in the UK, so I'm including it in mine. For me, that's still the film that I still can't quite describe how I felt watching that film. I don't think I've ever felt anywhere close to how I felt watching that film. It was so intense, so brilliant. It just
terrific,
blew
my
socks off.
That would probably be number two for me if I was counting it. But yeah, amazing. How about you, Emma? Have you got any kind of tally or?
I don't think I've seen five fucking films this year, to be honest.
When she moves, she just lies.
Yeah. I haven't even seen Age of Ultron. Kingsman is definitely up there. Inside Out. What the fuck else have I seen? An Age of Ultron. Because I literally haven't been able to get out to the cinema as much as I want this year. And
Hang on, there's one film that you're missing that I know you loved. What is it?
I don't know.
50 Shades of Grey.
Fuck off! Did you do that to me? Shut up! It's like I've blanked that from my mind. I don't know if there's just not been a lot out this year that I really wanted to see, but obviously I have been out over the summer for health reasons and things like that. I really enjoyed Jurassic World as well. I don't give a shit what people say about it on Twitter.
Yeah, it was fun.
I enjoyed it. But what are you guys looking forward to that's coming out in the next couple of weeks? Because I've just been having a look. I really want to see Everest, but I kind of feel like I'll have a panic attack and leave halfway through. I can't deal with stuff like that.
I'm looking forward to Legend.
Legend, yes, I want to see Legend. The Martian, really want to see The Martian.
Yeah, Damon, yeah.
And Crimson Peak.
Matt Damon.
And then I'll probably go see Goosebumps as well.
That's coming out. I'm looking forward to Macbeth as well.
Oh, yes.
I might drag someone to see Macbeth because I love Fassbender. Anyway, and Spectre's coming out.
Spectre's my number two of what I'm looking forward to for the rest of this year. I'm also quite looking forward to Black Mass, which is the Johnny Depp as Whitey Bulger
Yeah, I'm hoping he pulls off a kind of resurgence with that, because I think he's naff right now, because he hasn't made a decent film in years. But that's got an incredible cast. I'm a big fan of Joel Edgerton ever since, I think, was he in Great Gatsby?
I think so.
Pretty sure he was. And I think since that, I've been really interested to see. And Corey Stoll as well. I'm tempted to do an actor spotlight on him, because his career has just kind of gone from House of Cards, just as kind of, you know, sent him into stratosphere. You know, obviously he was in Ant-Man this year. He did, he's been doing The Strain.
I fucking love The Strain.
Yeah, which is a Del Toro series. Yeah. You know, it's, you know, he's got really, he's had a really interesting trajectory.
Mm. We've got, The Hateful Eight is on, supposedly on limited release towards the end of the year as well. Mm-hmm. And then, obviously, I expect every single person who comes on this podcast to bum the shit out of The Force Awakens.
Mm. Well, yeah. Me. I mean, The Hateful Eight, we're getting on January the 8th, apparently.
Oh, it's
according to current things, but that might change. I think Creed as well, I'm looking forward to. The Rocky one. That'll be good, I think, I'm hoping for. But yeah, it's all about Star Wars once we get to the end of the year. That is
I'm going to have to go see it just so I can sit here and go, no, you're wrong, and I know you're wrong, because I've actually seen it.
It's childish rubbish.
I fucking hate watching it. I'd probably come out and go, oh my god, it's completely changed me. I'm a Star Wars convert now. Quick, get me an R2-D2 tattoo. Dog, that's going to happen, but you never know.
I hope so. That'd be great.
I want to go see it just because everyone else is going to see it. I don't want to be left out, really.
You've got to stay in. You've got to stay in with it. But I think we're going to be covering most of these films over the next few months. We're going to be doing specials as well on Bond. There'll be a 007 special, which is going to cover all of Daniel Craig's tenure as Bond, which will be entertaining. We're going to do a Rocky special for Creed, which will be all the Rocky films. So that'll be good fun, talking about Rocky 4. That's mental, that film.
No.
Oh, Adrian! Rocky. So, and then we'll have to end the year off before we have a little Christmas break. Will be, a Star Wars special, in which a mega podcast in which we will go through all 7, it turns out.
I don't have to be on that one, do I?
No, it's fine. Good. I've already got like seven people on it.
Maybe we should be on it just so we can basically piss everyone else off by going, no, shit.
Should we just make Star Trek references the whole way through it?
Yes.
Yeah, you're not allowed. Do your own one.
But they won't be lost on them.
We'll do our own one with Blackjack and Buckies. Fuck off.
the only other person that chipped in on Twitter was Lee Scoville, at Porkchop Excess, who said for the hashtag FaveFilms2015, he agreed up with Whiplash and Mad Max, but he would also like to add Tokyo Tribe and It Follows, which obviously was kind of a big breakout horror, wasn't it? Mm. So of earlier this year, so
that'll be one to catch. There's a few we've missed, and we'll get to, but I think it's there's a lot of really exciting films to come for the rest of the year, and then going into 2016.
Oh,
so
next year as well. Yeah,
there's some great things coming up. So it's
next Civil War.
Civil War, Ghostbusters.
Love big kids.
We'll be there. Yeah. But until then, we'll call it a day, and we'll be back next week. I'll be in the hosting chair again. And until then, you can find us on Black Hole Cinema at Twitter, and on Facebook at Black Hole Cinema. And you can find the website, which is blackholeonline@wordpress.com. We will be getting a proper .com at some point and jazzing up the website. But that's where the blog posts come. And Emma does her Dead Meat blog posts, and Dan does his Trash Talk and various other ones. And I just rabble about anything, really. And we have other guest writers come on. So check us out. We try and get something up there every day. So, Dan, where can we find you on Twitter and stuff?
On Twitter, it's at Dan Thomas Taylor. Obviously, as you've already said, I do articles on Black Hole Online as well. So, I'm in and around everywhere.
Cool. That sounds vaguely disturbing.
You know it.
Yeah. Emma, what about you?
I'm on Twitter at Crushinator2, and like you said, I write the Dead Meat articles on Black Hole Cinema, and I might, for the next podcast, traumatise myself by watching Child's Play. If you go onto the blog, there's a whole post about how Child's Play actually traumatised me for life, and how I haven't seen it yet, and I'm still getting scared of Chucky. But for our lovely listeners, I might actually watch it. and talk about it on the next podcast.
I think you've got to do that now. You've got to do that now.
We actually potentially could launch a whole new YouTube purely on your reaction videos while watching that. Just film yourself watching that film. It'd be brilliant.
Even thinking about having to watch it is making me feel a bit sick. Like, that's how scared I am of this shit.
Yeah.
Put a camera in her face.
Yeah.
Just make sure Freddie is very far away.
I don't think Freddie would give a shit. Freddie's nails. He's part of him. He'd be like, fucking doll, stupid mum. Just what are you crying for? But yeah, I think I'm on the 27th.
Yes.
And I will be. I'm going to watch Child's Play.
Excellent. I like that. Yeah, Dan and Emma will be hosting when I'm not, and we're going to rotate as usual. So yeah, if you are listening to this and you want to be a guest, drop us a message. We're always welcome. We've got some new people coming on, which is very exciting, in the next few weeks, who've never been on Black Hole Cinema before. So that's going to be cool. So yeah, if you fancy guesting, please let us know, and we'll see what we can do. So. Yeah, this has been a catch-up, but we're back. We are back, and we're here to stay until we have another break. or one of us goes into hospital, or one of us moves house, or things like that. So
one
until
of us
then...
moved to Inverness, God.
Yes, at which point it'll be Daniel Taylor from Inverness.
Yeah, I don't even know the internet connection up there.
Yeah, that'd be fun. God, don't say that to me. Right, until then, we'll see you again. Keep watching them.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.